Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, June 9th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Let's start out by taking a look at the weather. For today, partly sunny with a southerly wind at 5 to 10 miles per hour, a high of 83 and a low of 60. Tomorrow, a slight chance of storms with a southerly wind at 5 to 15 miles per hour, a high is expected of 83 and a low of 62. On Sunday, there's a slight chance of showers with a northerly wind at 15 to 25 miles per hour, a high of 75 and a low of 53. Then come Monday, partly sunny with a westerly wind at 15 to 25 miles per hour, a high of 76 and a low of 56. Sunset tonight will be at 8:41, sunrise tomorrow morning at 5:31. Today, we will have 15 hours and 10 minutes of sunshine. Today's top weather story is from meteorologist Jan Reihard, who says, the latest drought monitor shows worsening conditions across the state. Severe drought now is present in eastern Iowa across parts of Blackhawk, Fayette, Bremer, and Buchanan counties, with moderate drought surrounding all of that. Severe drought also covers most of Davis County and several counties along the Missouri River out west. A total of 98.8% of the state is either classified as dry or under drought conditions, which is an increase of about 30% from 3 months ago. As of Monday, topsoil moisture across the state was rated 55% short or very short and 44% adequate. Subsoil moisture was rated 53% short or very short. A total of 94% of the state's corn has emerged, along with 87% soybeans, 8 to 10 days ahead of last year. And that's today's top weather story from meteorologist Jan Reihard. On today's front page is a story written by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette, Wanted: Sustainable Farm for Donated Solon Land. Dateline Solon. Brian Fleck's dream is to have a farmer move onto Bee Haven Farm. He built a tiny house for the purpose. Then start a produce farm and give Fleck a share of the tomatoes, peppers, and other crops. The 70-year-old Fleck of Iowa City said, right now, if you want to try it, I won't even charge you for it. Fleck and his wife Sabra, in 2020, donated their 40-acre Bee Haven farm near Solon to the Sustainable Iowa Land Trust, a West Branch nonprofit with a mission to preserve Iowa farmland for sustainable table food. The trust is known by its acronym SILT. It stands out from other organizations seeking land donations because it aims to keep farmland in production. SILT has preserved 1,200 acres on 16 farms in Iowa since 2015. A new campaign called Circle Our Cities sets a goal of creating 10 permanent food farms around 10 Iowa cities in 10 years. The first cities are Des Moines, Dubuque, Iowa City, and Fairfield. It wants to add Cedar Rapids and Council Bluffs. Brianna Horsey, who became executive director of SILT in February, said, when I came to Iowa, I was coming from Texas. The farms were very different there. I was completely blown away that us Iowans didn't grow our food here. About 94% of Iowa's farmed acres are in corn and soybeans, according to Iowa State University. Without diversified crops, Iowa's agricultural system is more vulnerable to pests, disease, and market volatility. SILT leases donated land to farmers who agree to produce, within 3 years, table food that is certified organic, naturally grown, or, in the case of raising animals, animal welfare approved. Horsey said, they have to do one, whichever is the best fit for them and their goals. Beyond produce or animals, farmers could plant berry bushes, fruit or nut trees, or another product consumed by humans. The first lease is 3 years, but if the arrangement works with both sides, they can sign a second lease for 20 years. While tenants don't own the land, they can build equity by investing in buildings or equipment. Silta will then buy back after the lease. The Flex bought Bee Haven Farm in 2007 as an investment. Brian Fleck, who published the Solon Economist from 1980 to 2000, had just completed an education degree and was looking for a teaching job. Maintaining the land was a burden in the early years. He said, "Then, when COVID happened, there was nothing else to do, and I started to spend my time out here." Fleck planted more than 3,000 native trees on 7 acres and established prairie grass and pollinator fields on the remainder of Bee Haven. He started keeping bees in 2018. Most of the land is in the Conservation Reserve program to regenerate the soil. Near the farm plot, Fleck has built a 650-square-foot building, now serving as a workshop. It's insulated with a mini-split heating and air conditioning unit, small wood stove, and a loft for sleeping. Soon, it will have solar panels. Fleck said, "Someday, hopefully, it will be a small home for somebody to live in." The Flecks decided to donate the farm to Silt because they believe in the group's mission, he said. He said, "I believe in the phrase, be the change you want to see in the world. My goal is to have land farmed without chemicals, hopefully planted with produce. Nothing against big farms, but I want to do something different." Speaking of different, this year, 68-year-old Virginia Hauser of Iowa City is using a slice of Bee Haven Farms to grow gourds. Hauser's husband, William Blair, makes one-of-a-kind art from the large bushel gourds, drying and hollowing them before shellacking the surface to preserve the mottled coloring. Hauser said, "It's hard to come by people who have this kind of land. The gourds are grown on small hillocks, and soon we'll have vines spreading 80 to 100 feet out from the plants." Finding affordable land to lease is a challenge to new farmers. The average cash rent for Iowa farmland increased 9% in 2023, according to ISU. Immigrants especially have struggled to find land to grow crops from their home countries. Silt charges below market rent, Horsey said, and went on to say the low cost of our leases is very appealing. Many of the farmers that farm our land might otherwise be leasing a portion of property on a shared space. Also on the front page today is a story written by both Aaron Murphy and Tom Barton of the Gazette. It says, "Iowa Senate Democrats oust Walz," Dateline Des Moines. With somewhat unusual timing, Iowa Senate Democrats elected a new leader Wednesday night. Republicans and Democrats in the Iowa legislature typically elect their respective leaders shortly after elections every 2 years, but on Wednesday night, Senate Democrats met and unanimously elected Dubuque Senator Pam Yoakum as their new leader, in the process ousting previous leader Senator Zach Walz of Coralville. Senate Democrats on Wednesday night and Thursday morning did not address the reason for the change. Yoakum and Walz did not immediately return messages seeking comment Thursday morning. The Iowa Capital Dispatch, Iowa Field Report, and Iowa Starting Line reported Wednesday that many Senate Democrats were upset that Walz, as caucus leader, recently fired two longtime staffers, Eric Baker and Debbie Kattenhorn. A person with knowledge of Senate Democrats' deliberations, who requested not to be identified, said the change in leadership stemmed from a dispute over Walz's dismissal of Baker and Kattenhorn. Their last day in office was June 2nd. Senator Molly Donahue, a Cedar Rapids Democrat, said, however, that the vote was most definitely not about one single issue, but would not elaborate. "There was an internal caucus decision," she said. "There were a lot of different reasons for all of it, and it is a great decision for our caucus." Donahue went on to say, "This was just something that needed to happen at this time, and it will be good for us in the long run. Everybody is still committed to making sure that we gain more seats and that we raise that money. And everyone will be putting in the work that needs to be put in to do so, including Senator Walz. He's just going to be in a different position. Baker served as a senior legislative aide to the Iowa Senate Democratic leader since the early 2000s and did not return a message seeking comment Thursday morning. Kattenhorn had worked in the Iowa Senate Democratic leaders since the mid-2000s, according to a state employee salary book. Jason Noble is communications director for Iowa Senate Democrats and declined to provide a copy of Walz's email to the caucus last week announcing the terminations and that he was restructuring the leader's office. He said, "It is an internal message to senators and staff concerning personnel matters that cannot be released." The 31-year-old Walz was first elected to the Iowa Senate in 2018 and in 2020 was elected leader of the minority party Senate Democrats, who are outnumbered in the chamber by Republican supermajority 34-16. Walz first gained prominence in 2011 when he spoke on the Iowa House floor about his two mothers as legislators debated a proposal to ban same-sex marriage in the state. The 68-year-old Jochim has served in the Iowa Senate since 2009 and before that had served in the Iowa House since 1993. In 2012, Jochim was chosen by fellow senators to serve as president of the Iowa Senate, becoming the second woman in Iowa to hold that position when Democrats last controlled the chamber until 2017. Most recently, she has served as one of four assistant minority leaders. Jochim said in a statement in which she thanked Walz for his visions and leadership, "I am honored to receive the unanimous support of my fellow Democratic senators for during this critical moment for our caucus and the state of Iowa. Senate Democrats look forward to offering a better way forward for the people of Iowa in 2024 and beyond. We're going to defend our incumbent senators, grow our caucus, and win a majority that delivers for middle-class Iowans." Jochim played a leading role in expanding affordable health insurance coverage to working Iowans and has been a staunch advocate for Iowans with disabilities to protect their health services following the privatization of Iowa's Medicaid system. Jochim often discussed her late daughter's severe intellectual disability to highlight frustrations within Iowa's Medicaid program. Senator Claire Selsey, a Democrat from West Des Moines, said, "Pam Jochim is highly qualified, highly dedicated, a Democrat that will lead our Senate caucus well." With Jochim's election, Iowa Democrats would boast all-female leadership in the Iowa legislature, assuming House Minority Leader Jennifer Confrest of Windsor Heights is reelected to the position. Women also currently serve in the number two leadership positions of the Democratic caucuses in the House and Senate, and the Iowa Democratic Party is led by Chair Rita Hart, a former state senator from Clinton County. This is believed to be a first for a major political party in Iowa. Donahue said, "We are all committed to making gains. It doesn't matter, male or female. It may be a pivotal moment to have all women in the lead, but it's just the way it happened at this point. Pam was the one that stepped up. I think it's great to have all women leadership." Donahue cited Jochim's long tenure in the Iowa legislature, working in leadership roles in both the minority and majority. She said, "She's been an integral part of the success of Democrats, and she is extremely passionate about getting us back to that point." The next session of the Iowa General Assembly convenes January 8th. From the Iowa Today page, we have a story written by Bailey Seacon of the Gazette. It says, "Drag and drive race burns rubber through Cedar Rapids." Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Cedar Rapids saw a parade of hundreds of hot rods Thursday as part of Sick Summer, an event that combines two distinctly American things, road trips and drag racing. The drag and drive race challenges car lovers to drive street-legal drag race cars to five Midwest racetracks in 5 days following a set route. At each track, cars run quarter-mile time trials for crowds of fellow hot rod lovers. The drag race cars must be driven to each track, stopping at checkpoints along the way. If something breaks, racers can make repairs, but they can only rely on the tools and parts they or other racers brought with them. hot rides by Havlicks in southwest Cedar Rapids served as a checkpoint Thursday as racers made their way along the route after completing runs at Tri-State Raceway in Earlville. This marked day 4 of the race. At the racetrack, Tony Wissman of West Liberty was in high spirits. The Gazette previously reported that Wissman had been rebuilding his 68 Dodge Dart GT for 12 years, much of it with the help of Brian and Jesse Havlick at Hot Rods by Havlicks. Hours before six summer tech testing began, Wissman's hot rod started. Wissman said, "We drove it literally a block up the road and a block back and loaded it up." His 23-year-old daughter, Tamra Wissman, surprised her dad by taking the week off work to watch him race. Tamra is set to inherit that 68 Dodge Dart GT, which Tony bought when she was 11. Tamra said, "I am so proud of him. It is an understatement. That first pass on Monday, after he came back around, I was in tears. I was so happy. It's been such a long journey. I've seen him get defeated by it, and then he gets excited again, and then defeated. So this week was so great." At the last minute, Wissman's 15-year-old son, Carter Wissman, asked to ride with Tony and his co-pilot, Tony's brother, Chris. He said, "I'm like, well, yeah, family comes first, and these are memories that will live forever." Tony went on to say, "My family has been following me around all week and keeping everybody posted because I haven't been able to. 'Cause it's been go, 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 and thrash, thrash, thrash." Wissman almost had to pull out of the race Wednesday when a distributor cap rotor blew up while doing a burnout and set the car on fire underneath the dashboard. Wissman said, "The last pass that we got, another friend of Brian's had the part, but he was in line to race and the lanes were closed." Meanwhile, the tracks were set to close in minutes. If Wissman couldn't make the pass, he would be out of the race. He said, "I was actually getting in the car as they were putting the part on." He was able to make his pass and stay in the race. Central City residents Anita and Gerald Silver brought their grandkids to Tri-State Raceway for the event Thursday. The Silvers said the boys are gearheads and love drag racing. Gerald said, "We have a couple cars at home. Every time the car fires, they're in it. So they like the noise and the smell of the fuel. It's a family tradition, I guess." Typically, the Silvers have to drive to Illinois or Minnesota for car events. Gerald Silver said, "I never thought we'd see one this close to home, which is cool. It makes it easy to bring the grandkids and come see an event like this and expose them to something like this." Brian and Jess Havlick love the challenge of drag and drive races and have competed in the past individually and together with Jess as the co-pilot. "This is not the type of road trip with car karaoke and spontaneous sightseeing. The co-pilot's job is to ensure they stay fed, hydrated, and in the race." Jess described the in-car dynamic by saying, "When we're driving the car, it's more like, 'Did you hear that? Does that sound okay? Should we pull over?' That's what our conversations are. But the first day, it's not too bad. But you get towards the end of the week, and you start hearing noises, and you start hearing things that don't seem right. That's the main conversation." When the Havlicks heard Sick Magazine was planning a Midwest route for Sick Summer 2023, they volunteered their shop as a checkpoint for the race. This invited hundreds of hot rods and drag race cars to the city. Brian said, "I guarantee you it'll be the most horsepower driving through Cedar Rapids ever." Brian Havlick competed in Sick Summer 2023 with his 17-year-old son, Briar Havlick, as co-pilot. Unfortunately, the engine problems cut their trip short. Sick Summer kicked off at Cordova Dragway in Illinois on Monday. After racing in Illinois and Wisconsin, racers came to Iowa before returning to Cordova Dragway to complete the route. Also on the Iowa Today page is a story written by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette, "CR Man Convicted in Federal Court for 7 Armed Robberies." Dateline, Cedar Rapids. A Cedar Rapids man with 7 felony convictions was found guilty Monday by a federal jury for armed robbery or attempting to rob 7 businesses in a 12-day crime spree in 2020. A jury found 28-year-old Cardell Demetrius Redmond guilty of 6 counts each of interference with commerce by robbery and using and possessing a firearm during and in furtherance of those robberies, and 1 count each of attempt to interfere with commerce by robbery and possession of a firearm by a felon. The jury deliberated about 6 hours following a 4-day trial in U.S. District Court. Evidence at trial showed Redmond robbed a Subway restaurant on November 17, 2020, by displaying a firearm to the employees and demanding the cash from the register. On November 19, Redmond robbed a cashier at gunpoint in the wine and spirits area of a Hy-Vee grocery store on Oakland Road Northeast. Redmond also robbed a Perkins restaurant and bakery on November 25th by pointing a firearm at one of the employees. 2 days later, on November 27th, he used a firearm to rob an employee at a Hy-Vee store on Mount Vernon Road Southeast. Minutes later, Redmond robbed 2 employees at gunpoint at the Little Caesars Pizza on Mount Vernon Road Southeast. Then, on November 28th, less than 24 hours later, Redmond attempted to rob 2 employees at the Hy-Vee drugstore on 6th Street Southwest by brandishing a firearm. But one of the employees told him there was a police officer in an unmarked car in the parking lot and Redmond fled. The next night, November 29th, Redmond robbed the same Subway restaurant as he hit on November 17th by pointing a firearm at an employee. He was arrested on burglary charges later that very night. Redmond remains in the custody of the U.S. Marshals Service pending sentencing. He faces a mandatory minimum of 42 years in federal prison and possibly a maximum of life. He also will be ordered to serve 5 years or more of supervised release following any prison term. The case is being prosecuted by Assistant U.S. Attorneys Kendra Lundquist and Tony Morfitt and was investigated by Cedar Rapids Police and assisted by the FBI. Here's a story written by Grace King of the Gazette. CR student athlete transfer policy will be reviewed. Dateline Cedar Rapids. A Cedar Rapids school policy that requires students to sit out of varsity sports for 365 days if they transfer to a school outside their residency area within the district is scheduled to be reviewed this fall. The policy will be up for discussion with the Policy Review Committee in September, according to Caitlin Weidenheft, who's a spokesperson for the Cedar Rapids Community School District. Cedar Rapids' policy is more stringent than the state's law, which generally prohibits students who transfer from one school or school district to another from participating in varsity athletics for 90 school days. This is the policy followed by surrounding school districts, including Iowa City, College Community, and Mount Vernon. School districts are allowed to implement policies that are more strict than the state rule. Tom Keating is executive director of the Iowa High School Athletic Association and says every district is allowed to go beyond that 90-day rule in place. Deb Fries is mother to a rising junior at Kennedy High School. Deb said the Cedar Rapids District's policy kept her daughter from playing varsity soccer this spring. Fries did not wish for her daughter's name to be published. Fries lives in the Jefferson High School attendance area and transferred her daughter from Xavier High School to Kennedy for the 2022-23 school year. The Cedar Rapids School District granted Fries' daughter on an in-district permit for her to attend Kennedy instead of Jefferson on April 27th of last year, according to a letter Fries shared with the Gazette. Fries' daughter was selected for the Kennedy High varsity girls soccer team, but was informed by the coaching staff the next day that she would not be able to compete on the team because she received a permit to attend Kennedy, which is outside her attendance area. However, Fries' daughter did qualify for and competed in varsity wrestling over the winter, an oversight on the part of the district, according to Fries. Fries, whose older child has been enrolled at Kennedy through an in-district permit for the school's special education program, said that parents are, quote, trying to make the best choice they can for their kids. That includes which school to send them to. She feels like her daughter was penalized for making the decision to attend Kennedy. A request for the district to appeal the decision was denied, according to Fries. Her daughter will be eligible to compete at the varsity level beginning this fall. Freeze said during a school board meeting April 10th, where she addressed the school board during public comment, "A lot has changed in our world and in our schools in 45 years. Matt Tiede, the athletic director for the Mount Vernon Community School District, said the state's 90-day law is intended to discourage students from transferring from one school to another just for its athletic programs. Students who transfer to a new school outside of their residential area can still participate in practice and play on teams other than varsity during the 90-day period," Tiede said. The Cedar Rapids policy follows state rules when it comes to inter-district transfers. If a student who lives outside the district boundaries transfers to a Cedar Rapids school, they are barred from varsity sports for only 90 days. The Cedar Rapids district policy also states that athletic participation should not be a reason that families pursue an in-district permit so their student can attend a school outside their residential attendance area. Now we go to the Insight page, where we do have a Gazette editorial today whose headline says, "Iowa Task Force 1 is valuable." According to the editorial, nobody wants a tragic situation that requires the use of an urban search and rescue team, but we value the expertise, training, and skills possessed by Iowa Task Force 1. Iowa Task Force 1 is an urban search and rescue team based at the Sioux City Fire Department and the Cedar Rapids Fire Department. The team once again drew difficult duty in the aftermath of an apartment building collapse in Davenport that claimed 3 lives and forced one resident to undergo the amputation of her left leg to free her from the rubble. The team was mobilized on Sunday, the day of the collapse, and Monday. Later in the week, the task force assisted in recovery operations. On Task Force 1's Facebook page, the response was called a challenging situation. "Work continues in Davenport. Crews are working 12-hour shifts and keeping up an amazing pace," according to a Facebook post on June 2nd that went on to say, "The collapsed sections of building are being sorted by hand before being carted off by motorized equipment. Temps are certainly taking a toll on the team, but a brief rainstorm is helping with dust control." It's been nearly 20 years since the Cedar Rapids and Sioux City departments were selected to sponsor Iowa State Urban Search and Rescue Team. Team members are trained in skills including confined space, high angle, and swift water rescues. They're trained to use dogs to assist search and rescue, in addition to training in engineering, emergency medical services, communications, and logistics. Most members of the task force work for the two departments, although some members are from other locations across the state. Over the years, the task force has been deployed in response to tornadoes in Parkersburg and Little Sioux Boy Scout Ranch, the floods of 2008, a Maquoketa Caves rescue, fires in Olwine, and at a former Yonkers store in downtown Des Moines, as well as multiple missing persons cases. The Davenport collapse can now be added to that list. "We hope the Davenport tragedy isn't repeated. In a state with cities and towns that are home to many aging buildings, it should be a wake-up call for local leaders, but we take some comfort knowing Iowa Task Force 1 is ready to respond." And that is the Gazette editorial. We have one community letter on the Insight page today, and it comes from Jim Walters of Iowa City. Jim says, "Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis joined in mutual backpatting on their gubernatorial achievements. I guess if you count cultural war coups, they're right. But what about the real business of governing, like dealing with disasters? You have to deal with disasters." Reynolds said that in a quote in a recent Wall Street Journal news story called "Iowa Governor Gets Good View of 24 Field." So how's she done? "We had a horrific environmental disaster in Marengo with the C60 explosion. Did she visit the scene? Meet and comfort the victims? Deal with the local officials and firefighters who've had to struggle with this? Not that I'm aware of. Instead, after always bellyaching about federal intrusion into state matters, she seems to have silently consented to letting the feds take over after the regulatory failures of her administration." Turning to DeSantis, his campaign pushes the notion that he heroically dealt with the damage and destruction of Hurricane Ian. The latest news reports say otherwise. Hundreds remain homeless at Fort Myers Beach. Storm survivors housed in recreational vehicles, a converted school bus, and even a shipping container. Debris cleanup has slowed to a crawl, and many areas will probably never be rebuilt. So, while these two governors are busily touting their credentials at trans bashing, teacher bashing, and woke bashing, stop and actually look at how they treat their own citizens in times of real disaster. That's a community letter from Jim Walters of Iowa City. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, June 9th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First off, we start with the shorter other notices. From Cedar Rapids, Brent Jenkins Jr., age 41, died Wednesday, June 7th. The Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Cedar Rapids is in charge of those arrangements. Also from Cedar Rapids, Charles Raymond Breedlove Jr., age 68, died Wednesday, June 7th. Assisting the family there will be the Tehan Funeral Home of Cedar Rapids. From Fairfax, Richard J. Divishek, age 71, died Wednesday, June 7th. Assisting the family will be the Abrash Chapel and the Ava Center of Cedar Rapids. And from Vinton, LaVon Bonnie Lillian Webster Westcott, age 84, died Wednesday, June 7th. Assisting the family will be the Van Steen Heights Tehan Funeral Home of Vinton. Now for the more extended and involved obituaries. S.F.C. Corey John Height, age 45 of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, June 4th, from complications from a car accident. Memorial services will be at 11 o'clock Monday morning at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories with full military honors. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is handling the arrangements. Memorials may be made to Veterans of Iowa in memory of Corey. Donald Williams, age 85, of Marion, passed away on Tuesday, June 6th. The family will greet friends from 3 to 8 p.m. Sunday, June 11th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A funeral mass will be held at 10 o'clock Monday morning, June 12th at St. Pius X Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids with Father John Sita as celebrant. Burial will follow at the Dunkard Cemetery in Toddsville. David Laverne Soden, age 77 of Marion, passed away peacefully at home on Tuesday, June 6th, and was united with his wife Susan again. A celebration of life will be held on Friday, June 16th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home from 4 to 7 p.m. Entombment will be private at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. The family requests casual dress for all services. Memorials may be directed to the family for the Grandchildren's College Fund. Harold Red Drew of Cedar Rapids passed away June 4th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. A gathering of family and friends will be held from 2 to 4 o'clock Tuesday afternoon, June 13th, at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood at 520 Wilson Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion is assisting the family. David Reiser Morcall, age 63 of Hiawatha, died Tuesday, June 6th. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 o'clock Friday night, June 9th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Services will be at 1 p.m. Saturday, June 10th, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the family to set up future school expenses for his grandchildren. Now let's move on to the sports page, where we have the story written by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette, and it says, still a twin. Gateline, Cedar Rapids. How many 66-year-old guys who are former Major League managers intentionally would be in the dugout at Veterans Memorial Stadium for 3 minor league baseball games? How many 66-year-old baseball Hall of Famers who were fired by an organization would still want to be part of that organization, leading them to being in the dugout at Veterans Memorial Stadium for 3 minor league baseball games? Paul Molitor would. He was in town recently to observe the Cedar Rapids Colonels as a special assistant of baseball operations for the parent Minnesota Twins. Molitor said. I still have a little baseball passion left in me. I can't really do the day-to-day anymore. My last go-round was managing, and that was 4.5 years ago. The Twins give me the opportunity to have some flexibility and go around and help with player development. I wouldn't say there is any one particular area that I concentrate on. My demonstrating days are pretty much over, but to have conversations with the younger players and even some of the young coaching staffs, I'm just trying to help them develop their skills as players and help them teach as coaches. Molitor's foray into professional baseball began in the Midwest League. A first-round pick of the Milwaukee Brewers, third overall in 1977 out of the University of Minnesota, he began his career with the Burlington Bees that summer. He went straight from Burlington to the big leagues, playing 21 years and getting 3,319 hits. He won a World Series as a member of the Toronto Blue Jays and was named World Series MVP in 1993. Molitor did some coaching and instructing work in the Twins organization after retiring following the 1998 season and ended up managing the Twins from 2015 to 18. He was American League Manager of the Year in 2017 and was let go after the 2018 season by the Twins President of Baseball Operations Derek Falvey and Senior Vice President and General Manager Thad Levine. Yet, 5 years later, he still is working for them. He said, I don't get long-winded about that. The Pollad family, which owns the Twins, said they hope somewhere along the way he gets to see another World Series for Minnesota. He said, the Pollad family's been good to me since I came back as a player over 25 years ago. I had some coaching experiences there as well as player development. Derek and Thad came in, and I worked with them for a couple of years in that particular role. Then, along with Dave St. Peter, the president of the Twins, is where I want to be as far as having any connection to the game. Hopefully, somewhere along the way, I get to see another World Series. Baseball has changed greatly since Molitor was a player and a lot since he stopped managing. It's such a meticulous game today with everything from the launch angle of a ball coming off the bat to specific biomechanical studying of pitchers' motions analyzed. The game has become about power, power hitting, and power pitching. Molitor said, I don't know if I'm amazed. There's been a little bit of gradualness to the changes. Some things have happened a little more quickly, obviously. During my tenure managing, analytics were becoming a little more prevalent, just in what we use and how we applied it in constructing lineups and managing games and all those types of things. I think it self-corrects a little bit along the way. He went on to say, I think the attempt to try and increase action like the pitch clock, the removing of the shift, I think is all good for baseball. It's starting to resemble the game back in the 80s and 90s and things like that. But yeah, it's always changing, just because we have a better way to analyze pretty much everything we do on the field at a higher level. But there's nothing like being able to talk baseball with a guy who is one of the best of his generation. That's something that Colonel's players could take advantage of during Molitor's recent visit. He said, I still enjoy it. I don't have to be out as much as some of the other rovers in our organization, but there's still something about minor league baseball. He said, I think it's great for our game, the communities that support the teams, whether it's the other leagues or the Midwest League that I get a chance to see. He said, I'm not sure how to value my input. Sometimes I wonder if I'm doing any good anymore because there's kind of a disconnect in how we're teaching the game now. But players are receptive. They like to talk about the game, he said. I don't talk about myself, my era, too much. It's pretty much just what I can see, pass it on, be helpful, and help these guys have a better chance to fulfill their dreams. Also on the sports page, we have a story written by Jeff Linder of the Gazette. Freshman lead for Kennedy. Dateline Cedar Rapids. Lily Knutson pitched the gem. Emerson Swearinger flashed the leather. Tegan Chrisman provided the thunder. Freshman, freshman, freshman. The 5A 13th-ranked Cedar Rapids Kennedy got major moments from its three starting ninth graders and edged 4A's number 4-ranked Cedar Rapids Xavier 2-1 in a crisp Mississippi Valley Conference softball game Wednesday night at Bobby Ruscha Field. Kennedy coach Madison LeClaire said, It's amazing how much of a difference 1 year of high school ball can make. It shows in their demeanor and their approach. Our future is bright. let's not wish away the present either. The Cougars improved to 10-3 overall and 7-2 in the MVC. Knutson, who limited the Saints to 3 hits and no earned runs, said, "We're young, but we have a chance to be good for a long time." She struck out 5, walked just 1, and hit a batter. The defensive play of the game, and one which surely will go down as one of the best of the season, came in the bottom of the 3rd. Xavier's Braylon Conlon lined a gapper to right center field, but Kennedy center fielder Swearinger tracked it down near the fence. Knutson said, "That was awesome. Emerson goes 100% all the time, and it shows out." Swearinger, who burst onto the prep scene during the track season, is a catcher by trade, but with Albert behind the plate for one more season, LeClaire had to find a spot on the field for Swearinger. LeClaire said, "Somebody has to take charge out there, and Emerson sure did on that play." With one out of the top of the 4th, Crispin hit the first home run of her high school career, a solo shot to center field on a full count. She said, "That felt really good. My hitting has been a little off. I've been chopping off the ball." Cedar Rapids Prairie softball coach Alicia Fries earned her 500th career victory on Wednesday when the Hawks completed the sweep of Cedar Rapids Washington, both by 11-1 scores. Fries had fashioned a 69-46 mark in 3-plus seasons at Prairie after compiling a 431-253 record in 16 years at Dubuque Hempstead. Her overall record now as a coach is 500 wins, 299 losses. Here's a story written by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette concerning the D3 National Championships in Cedar Rapids. Jeff says, "Not quite a perfect tournament, but still a greatly productive one. The University of Lynchburg overcame a 4-0 deficit after a half inning and beat Johns Hopkins 7-6 last night to win the NCAA Division III Baseball Champion Tournament in Veterans Memorial Stadium. The Virginia school made its first D3 World Series a memorable one, winning 4 of 5 games at this 8-team week-long tournament. Johns Hopkins forced a deciding Game 3 in the championship series of the tourney with an 11-6 win earlier on Thursday. This is the end of the tournament's 4-year run in Cedar Rapids. It'll be played next year at East Lake, Ohio. The Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union has released its softball rankings for the year. In Class 5A, Ankeny Centennial is number 1, Linmar is 5th, Cedar Rapids Kennedy is 11th, while in Class 4A, the leader is Indianola. Cedar Rapids Xavier is number 11, Clear Creek Amana is number 12. In Class 3A, Williamsburg leads the way, Mount Vernon is 6th, Solon is 8th, Center Point Urbana is 10th. In 2A, the state leader is Iowa City Regina, with Wilton number 5. North Lynn leads in Class 1A, with Sigourney 5th. As we now turn back to the news section of the Gazette, here's a story written by Jay Wagmeister of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. It has a local angle. It says, "Appeals accepting applications to fill vacancy." The Iowa Court of Appeals is looking to fill a recent vacancy and will accept applications until July 3rd. The State Judicial Nominating Commission will nominate 5 applicants and present them as candidates for consideration by Governor Kim Reynolds. Judge Anarwalda Vashwaran's retirement opened one of the 9 spots on the Court of Appeals. Vashwaran went to high school in Cedar Rapids and attended Grinnell College for her undergraduate degree and the University of Iowa for her law degree and master's in political science. She was appointed to the court in 1999. The nominating commission will accept public comment on applicants until July 9th. Here's a story written by Emily Anderson of the Gazette, "Lone Tree Man Charged with Sex Abuse." A Lone Tree man was arrested this week on charges that he sexually abused a woman he met at a bar in Iowa City. 23-year-old Aaron Raymond Slaughter is facing 1 count of third-degree sexual abuse. According to a criminal complaint, he met a woman on February 25th at a bar in downtown Iowa City through a mutual acquaintance. The woman told investigators she remembers having a couple of drinks but doesn't remember leaving the bar. Video surveillance showed Slaughter and the woman leaving the bar together. The complaint states that she remembers waking up in Slaughter's truck while he sexually abused her. She asked him to stop, which he refused to do. Slaughter dropped the woman off at a residence, but the residents there didn't know Slaughter or the woman. The residents told police the woman appeared almost unconscious in the back of the truck and that she had blood on her and her clothes were disheveled. Blood and other DNA found on Slaughter matched the woman's DNA, according to the complaint. Slaughter was arrested Monday and made his first appearance in court this past Tuesday. He was released from jail after posting a $10,000 bond. A no-contact order has been filed on behalf of the victim. Along those same lines, here's another story written by Emily Anderson of the Gazette. North Liberty man charged with sexually abusing 10-year-old. A North Liberty man was arrested Tuesday on charges that he sexually abused a 10-year-old child when he was 16. 22-year-old Wilmer Ernesto Garcia Espinal is charged with second-degree sexual abuse. According to a criminal complaint, Garcia Espinal sexually abused the child at a residence in Iowa City on August 22, 2017. The child reported this instance and other instances of abuse at the St. Luke's Child Protection Center in Hiawatha. The child also shared that Garcia Espinal massaged her, asking her to be his girlfriend. Garcia Espinal confirmed the messages in an interview with investigators, but said he was never at the location of the assault with the child and had been there only once in passing. Photo evidence from the night of the assault shows Garcia Espinal and the child together, and metadata from a photo taken of Garcia Espinal on the child's phone shows the photo was taken at the location of the sexual abuse. A no-contact order has been filed on behalf of the victim. Garcia Espinal is being held in the Johnson County Jail on a $20,000 bond. Moving to the business page, we have a story written by the Gazette. Collins unveils wireless galley tool for planes. Collins Aerospace has introduced a tool to quickly diagnose problems with the appliances in airplane galleys where food and beverages are prepared, or with water or power supplies. According to a Collins news release, this data provides the information needed to quickly identify unit faults, decreasing the time spent troubleshooting and reducing occurrences of misdiagnosing unit malfunctions. In the future, the data gathered ultimately could predict failures before they happen, allowing airlines to better plan and fix problems before they occur. The technology will allow airlines to make informed decisions without excessive investment or aircraft modification time, according to Allison Davidson, who is vice president and general manager of cabin products for Collins Aerospace. The wireless tool integrates easily with existing in-flight Wi-Fi networks, requiring a minimal amount of data to transmit information to maintenance staffs and crew members without overwhelming network services. The wirelessly connected galley technology was displayed this week at the Aircraft Interiors Expo in Hamburg, Germany. Raytheon Technologies is the parent company of Collins Aerospace, which is the largest private employer in Cedar Rapids. Also on the business page is a story written by members of the Gazette, Fairway and Alliant partner on solar field. Fairway Stores and Alliant Energy broke ground this week on a 1-megawatt solar field that will be built in the Boone Industrial Park adjacent to Fairway's campus in Boone. Fairway officials say they've been incorporating sustainable practices since the grocery chain started 85 years ago. The business now has 135 stores in 7 states. Fairway President Garrett Picklap said, "We are proud to extend our tradition of sustainable practices and look forward to advancing our initiatives in partnership with Alliant Energy." He went on to say, "We strive to be good stewards of our resources, so this solar field is a conscious decision to employ technology that furthers our reach in energy efficiency, not only for the environment, but to also better serve our customers." The field's 2,000 solar panels will cover 6 acres. It's one of Alliant Energy's first customer-hosted solar projects in Iowa, with others under construction in Marshalltown and Perry. The project is part of Alliant Energy's customer hosted renewables program, which enables customers with available land to host solar facilities. In return, they receive lease payments for the next two decades and renewable energy credits. The project also furthers Alliant's goal to achieve net zero carbon dioxide emissions by 2050. The solar field will be located on undeveloped land that Fairway owns on the western edge of its distribution center in the Boone Industrial Park. Alliant Energy will design, construct, own, operate, and maintain the solar field. It's expected to be in operation by year's end, the company said in a news release. Here's a national story that could have local implications. It's about government grant scams. Scammers will ask for your banking info, then take your money. Free government money that never has to be repaid? If this sounds too good to be true, that's because it's the hook for an all-too-common con. This scam promises free money in the form of a government grant to use in any way you desire. The only hitch is sharing all your personal identifying information and paying a nominal fee in advance. This is not a new scam, but some of the tactics being used are. Scammers make contact through mailings, phone calls, emails, or more recently, posts on social media. No matter the medium, the message is similar. The government is awarding free grants. After being told that an application is guaranteed to be accepted, the final incentive is noting that the grant recipient never will have to repay the money. The scammer says the grant may be used on anything, and that it could be used to pay bills or make repairs or for education costs. Once the victim replies to the ad or takes the bait, scammers explain the process and identify themselves as, quote, a government agent, frequently referring to their association with a familiar-sounding federal agency. The con artist offers congratulations on being eligible for the grant and then asks for a one-time delivery fee or processing fee. Once paid, other fees inevitably follow, all seeming official. Whatever the story, one thing is certain, you will never see the money. Free money doesn't come easy. Scammers want the public to believe government grants are there for the taking. In reality, obtaining a government grant is an involved process where the grant seeker pursues the funds, not the other way around. If someone is soliciting a grant award, it's a red flag. So, do not pay any money for a free government grant. If you have to pay a claim to get a free government grant, it is not free. Never pay anything in crypto, gift cards, or wire transfer. A real government agency will not ask for an advance fee. The only official list of all U.S. grant-making agencies is www.grants.gov. Check for lookalikes. Callers may say they are with the Federal Grants Administration, which does not exist. Be sure to research and see if an agency or organization actually does exist. Find contact information and call for verification. Be careful with unsolicited calls asking for banking information. Scammers will cold call, asking basic questions to qualify for a grant, and then ask for banking information to collect the one-time processing fee and to directly deposit the purported grant proceedings. Here's a health-related story. If you're struggling to reach 10,000 steps a day, here's some good news. The latest science suggests fewer daily steps may be the sweet spot for many of us, depending on our age, fitness, and health goals. There is nothing magical or evidence-based about 10,000 steps a day, so feel free to let go of that goal. The notion to take 10,000 daily steps stems from a marketing ploy. As the 1964 Tokyo Summer Olympics approached, a Japanese researcher decided to nudge his nation to be more active by offering pedometers with a name that loosely translated as 10,000 step meter. In the past few years, multiple large-scale studies have looked closely into how many steps we probably need for our health and longevity. In the largest published last year in the Lancet Public Health, dozens of global researchers pooled data from 15 earlier step count studies, with some unpublished, covering 47,000 adults of all ages, and compared their typical daily step counts to their longevity. The sweet spot for step counts was not 10,000 or more. In general, the pooled data showed that for men and women younger than 60, the greatest relative reductions in the risk of dying prematurely came with step counts of between 8 and 10,000 per day. For people older than 60, the threshold was a little lower. For them, the sweet spot in terms of reduced mortality risk came at between 6,000 and 8,000 steps a day. The benefits also weren't confined to longevity. Step counts of at least 8,000 a day for adults substantially lowered risk for heart disease, type 2 diabetes, dementia, depression, many types of cancer, and even sleep apnea. And that's going to do it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, June 9th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.